The Uncertainty Principle. Kai Kraus, software pioneer, philosopher, author, The History of the Future. It was born out of a mistranslation and has been misused ever since. But let us do a little thought experiment first. Let's say you're a scientist and you notice a phenomenon you'd like to tell the world about. The brain, you say, can listen to a conversation and make sense of the frequencies, decode them into symbols and meaning, but when it's confronted with two such conversations simultaneously, it cannot deal with both threads in parallel. At best, it can switch back and forth quickly, trying to keep up with the information. So much for your theory. You formulate your findings and share it with colleagues. It gets argued and debated, just as it should be. But now something odd happens. Although all your discussions were in English, and you wrote down your idea in English, and a large percentage of leading scientists and Nobel laureates are English-speaking, somehow the prevailing language for publication is Mongolian. There's a group in Ulaanbaatar merrily examining your findings with great interest, and your theory shows up all over the place, in Mongolian. But here's the catch. You wrote that it's not possible to listen to two conversations at the same time, and thus their meaning to you is undefined until you decide to follow one of them properly. However, as it turns out, Mongolian has no such word as undefined. Instead, it got translated with an entirely different term, uncertain. And the general interpretation of your theory has suddenly mutated from one or the other of two conversations will be unknown to you, to the rather distinctly altered interpretation, you can listen to one, but the other will be entirely meaningless. Saying that I am unable to understand both conversations properly is one thing, but my inability to perceive it does not render each of the conversations suddenly meaningless, does it? All of this is, of course, just an analogy. But it's pretty close to exactly what did happen, just the other way around. The scientist was Werner Heisenberg. His observation was not about listening to simultaneous conversations, but measuring the exact position and momentum of a physical system, which features he described as impossible to determine at the same time. And although he discussed this with numerous colleagues in German, Einstein, Pauli, Schrödinger, Bohr, Lorentz, Born, Planck, just to name some of the Solvay conference group of 1927, the big step came in the dissemination in English. And there's the Mongolian in our analogy. Heisenberg's idea had quickly been dubbed Unschärfe-Relation, which transliterates into unsharpness relationship. But as there's really no such term in English, blurred, fuzzy, vague, and ambiguous have all been tried, the translation ended up as the uncertainty principle, when he hadn't used either word at all. Some point to Eddington. And what followed is really quite close to the analogy as well. Rather than stating that either position or momentum is as yet undetermined, it became common usage and popular wisdom to jump to the conclusion that there is complete uncertainty at the fundamental level of physics, nature, and even free will, and the universe as such. Laplace's demon was killed as collateral damage. Obviously, his days were numbered anyway. Einstein remained skeptical his entire life. To him, the Unbestimmtheit, indeterminacy, was on the part of the observer not realizing certain aspects of nature at this stage in our knowledge, rather than proof that nature itself is fundamentally undetermined and uncertain. In particular, implications like Fernwirkung, action at a distance, appeared to him spukhafte, spooky, eerie. But even in the days of quantum computing, qubits, and tunneling effects, I still would not want to bet against Albert. His intuitive grasp of nature survived many critics, and waves of counterproof ended up counter-counter-proved. And while there is plenty of reason to defend Heisenberg's findings, it's sad to see such a profound meme in popular science based merely on a loose attitude toward translation. There are many other such cases. I would love to encourage writers in French or Swedish or Arabic to point out the idiosyncrasies and unique value of those languages, not for a semantic pedantry, but for the benefit of alternate approaches. German is good not only for Verfergnügen, Weltanschauung, and Zeitgeist. There are many wonderful, subtle shades of meaning. It's like a different tool to apply to thinking, and that's a good thing. A great hammer is a terrible saw. Beware of arrogance. Retire nothing. Ian McEwan, novelist, author, Amsterdam, On Chesil Beach, Solar, The Children Act. Beware of arrogance. Retire nothing. A great and rich scientific tradition should hang on to everything it has. Truth is not the only measure. There are ways of being wrong that help others to be right. Some are wrong, but brilliantly so. Some are wrong, but contribute to method. Some are wrong, but help found a discipline. Aristotle ranged over the whole of human knowledge and was wrong about much. But his invention of zoology alone was priceless. Would you cast him aside? You never know when you might need an old idea. It could rise again one day to enhance a perspective the present cannot imagine. It would not be available to us if it were fully retired. Even Darwin in the early 20th century experienced some neglect until the modern synthesis. The expression of the emotions took longer to be current. William James also languished, as did psychology, once consciousness as a subject was retired from it. Look at the revived fortunes of Thomas Bayes and Adam Smith, especially the theory of moral sentiments. We may need to take another look at the long-maligned Descartes. Epigenetics might even restore the reputation of Lamarck. Freud may yet have something to tell us about the unconscious. Every last serious and systematic speculation about the world deserves to be preserved. We need to remember how we got to where we are, and we'd like the future not to retire us. Science should look to literature and maintain a vibrant, living history as a monument to ingenuity and persistence. We won't retire Shakespeare, nor should we Bacon. Big Data. Gary Marcus, cognitive scientist, New York University. Author, Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. No, I don't literally mean we should stop believing in or collecting big data. But we should stop pretending that big data is magic. There are few fields that wouldn't benefit from large, carefully collected data sets, but lots of people, even scientists, put more stock in big data than they should. Sometimes it seems as if half the talk about understanding science these days, from physics to neuroscience, was about big data and associated tools like dimensionality reduction, neural networks, machine learning algorithms, and information visualization. Big data is without a doubt the idea of the moment. 39 minutes ago, as of this writing, according to the big data driving Google News, Gordon Moore, for whom Moore's Law is named, gave big to big data. MIT debuted an online course for big data 44 minutes ago, and big data was voted Strategy and Business's Strategy of the Year. Forbes had an article about big data a few hours before that. There were 163,000 hits for a search for big and data and science. But science still revolves fundamentally around a search of the laws that describe our universe, and the one thing big data isn't particularly good at is, well, identifying laws. Big data is brilliant at detecting correlation. The more robust your data set, the better chance you have of identifying correlations, even complex ones involving multiple variables. But correlation never was causation and never will be. All the big data in the world won't by itself tell you whether smoking causes lung cancer. To really understand the relationship between smoking and cancer, you need to run experiments and develop mechanistic understandings of things like carcinogens, oncogenes, and DNA replication. Merely tabulating a massive database of every smoker and non-smoker in every city in the world, with every detail about when they smoked, where they smoked, how long they lived, and how they died, would not, no matter how many terabytes it occupied, be enough to induce all the complex underlying biological machinery. If it makes me nervous when people in the business world put too much faith in big data, it makes me even more nervous to see scientists do the same. Certain corners of neuroscience have taken on an "if we build it, they will come" attitude, presuming that neuroscience will sort itself out as soon as we have enough data. It won't. If we have good hypotheses, we can test them with big data, but big data shouldn't be our first port of call. It should be where we go once we know what we're looking for.
The Stratigraphic Column. Christine Finn, archaeologist, journalist, author, Artifacts, An Archaeologist's Year in Silicon Valley. Digging for the past has timed out. Digerati are the gatherers now. The law of stratigraphy has held well for archaeology as a means and a concept. The vertical quest exposing time's layers to be read like a book of changes. The exactitude associated with the act of going down, with that of going back and understanding human behavior through geology. The Victorians took up barrow digging and brought the old stuff home as souvenirs of a Sunday pursuit. Then archaeologists called it a science, employed the same tools as grave diggers, spades, buckets, descended 6 feet under, and brought exactitude to the trenches. But even Schliemann's 19th-century tunneling through layers of dull, to him, prehistory in search of gold, was in some ways a prelude to what we have now, exposure to an accumulation of relative yesterdays. We cherry-pick the past. Time zone concerns are so over. Blogs are a hoard of content, only as fresh as the day they're retrieved. Archive photos and just-taken selfies get uploaded together onto timelines that run laterally. Half-forgotten news hangs around the Internet, and it surfaces, that old-school term again, as new news to the fresh viewer. So what is fieldwork now? Look to the newish field of contemporary archaeology, which has its excavators channeling anthropology. These are surface workers, seeing escalating and myriad rates of change as lateral observations that connect a series of presents which oscillate and merge new and old. No hands get dirty in this type of dig, but what is dug up tends to linger under the fingers.
The Habitable Zone Concept. Dimitar D. Sasolov, Professor of Astronomy, Harvard University. Director, Harvard Origins of Life Initiative. Author, The Life of Super-Earths. The habitable zone defines those distances from a star where an Earth-like planet would have the surface temperatures for water to be liquid. In our solar system, this zone stretches from midway between the orbits of Venus and Earth out to Mars. Its boundaries are approximate, applied to different planetary systems, and sometimes the concept applies more broadly, for example, to our galaxy. The habitable zone concept has a venerable history in the search for life beyond Earth. Most recently, it has contributed to the spectacular success of NASA's Kepler exoplanet hunting mission. However, in the post-Kepler era, it's a scientific concept ready for retirement. The simple definition of the zone is appealing to use in statistical estimates of habitable planets, because it depends on just a few parameters that are easy to measure. The idea is also easy to grasp. Not too hot, not too cold. The Goldilocks zone. Simple and robust statistics are crucial to estimating the abundance and distribution of small rocky planets like Earth in the galaxy, and the Kepler space mission excelled at that. If our goal now is to search for life, then it's good to know where we should be heading, to habitable exoplanets. But the habitable in the habitable zone is a misnomer, or at least a gross overstatement, since it isn't the zone per se that is habitable, but certain planetary environments, which may even exist outside it. In our own solar system, we contemplate alien life beyond the zone's confines on certain moons of Jupiter and Saturn. Today we need a concept of what makes an environment habitable, capable of letting life emerge and of sustaining it over geological timescales, be it on a planet or a moon. Finding out what makes a planet living and how to recognize a living planet with our telescopes is the big question. The year 2013 was a historic one in the search for alien life. Thanks to Kepler and other exoplanet surveys, we now know that Earth-like planets are so common that many close analogs to our home planet should reside in our neighborhood of the galaxy. This makes them amenable to remote sensing exploration with existing technology and telescopes under construction. The search for life is set to begin, but we need to understand better what to look for. In retiring the habitable zone concept, it makes sense to revert to its original mid-20th century name, the liquid water belt, a region important to the rich geochemistry of rocky planets. Living planets there will feel like home to us.
Robot Companions. Sherry Turkle, Abby Rockefeller Mose Professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology, MIT. Author, Alone Together. In the early 1980s, I interviewed a young student of Marvin Minsky's, one of the founders of artificial intelligence. The student told me that as he saw it, his hero, Minsky, was trying to build a machine beautiful enough that a soul would want to live in it. More recently, we are perhaps less metaphysical, more practical. We envisage elder care bots, nanny bots, teacher bots, sex bots. To go back to Minsky's student, these days, we're trying to invent machines not that souls would want to live in, but that we would want to live with. We are trying to invent machines that a self would want to love. The dream of the artificial confidant and then love object confuses categories best left unmuddled. Human beings have bodies and a life cycle, live in families, and grow up from dependence to independence. This gives them experiences of attachment, loss, pain, fear of illness, and of course the experience of death, that are specific and that we don't share with machines. I don't mean that machines can't get smart or learn a stunning amount of things, more things certainly than people can know, but they're the wrong object for the job when we want companionship and love. A machine companion for instrumental help, to keep you safe in your home, to help with cleaning or with reaching high shelves, is an excellent idea. A machine companion for conversation about human relationships seems a bad one. A conversation about human relationships is species-specific. These conversations depend on both parties having the experiences that come from having a human body, human limitations, a human life cycle. I see us embarked on a voyage of forgetting. We forget about the care and conversation that can pass only between people. The word conversation derives from words that mean to tend to each other, to lean toward each other. To converse, you have to listen to someone else, put yourself in their place, read their body, their voice, their tone, their silences. You bring your concern and experience to bear, and you expect the same. A robot that shares information is an excellent project. But if the project is companionship and mutuality of attachment, you want to lean toward a human. When we think, for example, about giving children robot babysitters, we forget that what makes children thrive is learning that people care for them in a stable and consistent way. When children are with people, they recognize how the movement and meaning of speech, voice, inflection, faces, and bodies flow together. Children learn how human emotions play in layers, seamlessly and fluidly. No robot has this to teach. There's a general pattern in our discussions of robot companionship. I call it from better than nothing to better than anything. I hear people begin with the idea that robot companionship is better than nothing, as in, there are no people for these jobs. For example, jobs in nursing homes or as babysitters. And then they start to exalt the possibilities of what simulation can offer. In time, people start to talk as though what we could get from the artificial might be better than what life could provide. Child care workers might be abusive. Nurses might make mistakes. Nursing home attendants might not be clever or well-educated. The appeal of robotic companions carries our anxieties about people. We see artificial intelligence as a risk-free way to avoid being alone. We fear we won't be there to care for each other. We're drawn to the robotic because it offers the illusion of companionship without the demands of friendship. Increasingly, people even suggest that it might offer the illusion of love without the demands of intimacy. We're willing to put robots in places where they have no place, not because they belong there, but because of our disappointments with each other. For a long time, putting hope in artificial intelligence or robots has expressed an enduring technological optimism, a belief that as things go wrong, science will go right. In a complicated world, robots have always seemed like calling in the cavalry. Robots save lives in war zones, in operating rooms. They can function in deep space, in the desert, in the sea, wherever the human body would be in danger. But in the pursuit of artificial companionship, we're not looking for the feats of the cavalry, but the benefits of simple salvations. What are the simple salvations? These are the hopes that artificial intelligences will be our companions, that talking with us will be their vocation, that we'll take comfort in their company and conversation. In my research over the past 15 years, I've watched these hopes for the simple salvations persist and grow stronger, even though most people don't have experience with an artificial companion at all, but with something like Siri, Apple's digital assistant on the iPhone, where the conversation is most likely to be, locate a restaurant, or locate a friend. But what my research shows is that even telling Siri to locate a friend moves quickly to the fantasy of finding a friend in Siri, something like a best friend, but in some ways better. One you can always talk to, one that will never be angry, one you can never disappoint. When people talk this way, about friendship without mutuality, about friendship on tap, the simple salvations of artificial companionship don't seem so simple to me. For the idea of artificial companionship to become our new normal, we have to change ourselves, and in the process, we're remaking human values and human connection. We change ourselves even before we make the machines. We think we're making new machines, but really, we're remaking people.
Artificial Intelligence. Roger Shank, Artificial Intelligence Theorist, Executive Director, Engines for Education, Author, T. Teaching Minds. It was always a terrible name, but it was also a bad idea. Bad ideas come and go, but this particular idea, that we would build machines that are just like people, has captivated popular culture for a long time. Nearly every year, a new movie or a new book appears with a new kind of robot that's just like a person. But that robot will never appear in reality. It's not that artificial intelligence has failed. No one actually ever tried. There, I said it. Oxford physicist David Deutsch has said, "No brain on Earth is yet close to knowing what brains do. The enterprise of achieving it artificially, the field of artificial intelligence, has made no progress whatever during the entire 6 decades of its existence." He adds that he thinks machines that think like people will happen someday. Let me put that remark in a different light. Will we eventually have machines that feel emotions like people? When that question is asked of someone in AI, the response might be about how we could get a computer to laugh or cry or be angry. But actually feeling? Or let's talk about learning. A computer can learn, can't it? That's artificial intelligence right there. No machine would be smart if it couldn't learn. But does the fact that machine learning has enabled the creation of a computer that can play Jeopardy or provide data about purchasing habits of consumers mean that AI is on its way? The fact is that the name AI made outsiders to AI imagine goals for AI that AI never had. The founders of AI, with the exception of Marvin Minsky, were obsessed with chess playing and problem solving. The Tower of Hanoi problem was a big one. A machine that plays chess well does just that. It isn't thinking, nor is it smart. It certainly isn't acting like a human. The chess-playing computer won't play worse one day because it drank too much the night before or had a fight with its wife. Why does this matter? Because a field that started out with a goal different from what its goal was perceived to be is headed for trouble. The founders of AI, and those who work on AI still, me included, want to make computers do things they cannot now do in the hope that something will be learned from this effort or that something will have been created that's of use. A computer that can hold an intelligent conversation with you would be potentially useful. I'm working on a program now that will hold an intelligent conversation about medical issues with a user. Is my program intelligent? No. The program has no self-knowledge. It doesn't know what it's saying, and it doesn't know what it knows. The fact that we've stuck ourselves with this silly idea of intelligent machines, or AI, causes people to misperceive the real issues. I declare artificial intelligence dead. The field should be renamed "The Attempt to Get Computers to Do Really Cool Stuff," but of course it won't be. You'll never have a friendly household robot with whom you can have deep, meaningful conversations. I happened to be a judge at last year's Turing test, known as the Loebner Prize. The stupid stuff that was supposed to be AI was just that, stupid. It took maybe 30 seconds to figure which was a human and which was a computer. People don't just get fed knowledge. I've raised a couple of people myself. I fed them food, not knowledge. I answered their questions, but those were their own self-generated questions. I tried to help them get what they wanted, but it was, and is, their own deeply felt wants I was dealing with. Humans are born with individual personalities and their own set of wants and needs, and they express them early on. No computer starts out knowing nothing and gradually improves by interacting with people. We always kick that idea around when we talk about AI, but no one ever does it, because it really isn't possible. Nor should it be the goal of the field formerly known as AI. The goal should be figuring out what great stuff people do and seeing if machines can do bits and pieces of that. A chess-playing computer is nice to have, I suppose, but it won't tell you much about how people think, nor will it suddenly get interested in learning a new game to play because it's bored with chess. There really is no need to create artificial humans anyway. We have enough real ones already.
The mind is just the brain. Tanya Lombroso, Associate Professor of Cognitive Psychology, University of California, Berkeley. In the beginning, there was dualism. Descartes famously posited two kinds of substance, non-physical mind and material body. Leibniz differentiated mental and physical realms. But dualism faced a challenge, explaining how mind and body interact. The mind executes an intention to raise a finger, and behold, it rises. The body brushes against something sharp, and the mind registers pain. We now know, of course, that mind and brain are intimately connected. Injuries to the brain can alter perceptual experience, cognitive abilities, and personality. Changes in brain chemistry can do the same. There's no mental substance that appears along some phylogenetic branch of our evolutionary history, nor a point in ontogeny during which we receive a non-physical infusion of mind stuff. We've come a long way from Ambrose Bierce's formulation of the mind in the Devil's Dictionary as a mysterious form of matter secreted by the brain. In fact, it appears the mind is just the brain. Or perhaps, to quote Marvin Minsky, minds are simply what brains do. If we want to understand the mind, we should look to neuroscience and the brain for the real answers. Or maybe not. In our enthusiasm to find a scientifically acceptable alternative to dualism, some of us have gone too far the other way, adopting a stark reductionism. Understanding the mind is not just a matter of understanding the brain. But then, what is it a matter of? Many alternatives to the mind equals brain equation seem counterintuitive or spooky. Some suggest that the mind extends beyond the brain to encompass the whole body, or even parts of the environment, or that the mind is not subject to the laws of physics. Are there other options? Indeed, there are. But given that mind and brain are pretty heady matters, so to speak, it helps to think about a more concrete and tastier example. Consider baking. I'm an anti-reductionist about baking. It's not that I believe in a cake substance materially distinct from flour and sugar and leavening, and it's not that I think cakes have some magical metaphysical property, though the best ones sort of do. The tenets of baking anti-reductionism are far less controversial, and they stem from what we want our theory of baking to provide. We want to understand why some cakes turn out better than others, and what we can do to achieve better baked goods in the future. Should we change an ingredient? Mix the batter less vigorously? Answering these questions can appeal to chemistry and physics, but a theory of baking wouldn't be very useful formulated in terms of molecules and atoms. As bakers, we want to understand the relationship between, for example, mixing and texture, not between kinetic energy and protein hydration. The relationships between the variables we can tweak and the outcomes we care about happen to be mediated by chemistry and physics, but it would be a mistake to adopt cake reductionism and replace the study of baking with the study of physical and chemical interactions among cake components. Of course, you could decide you're not interested in baking, and thus reject the theoretical constructs of my baking theory in favor of chemistry and physics. But if you are interested in the project of explaining, predicting, and controlling the quality of your baked goods, you'll need something like a baking theory to work with. Now consider the mind. Most of us are interested in a theory of the mind because we want to explain, predict, and control behaviors, mental states, and experiences. Given that mental phenomena are physically realized in the brain, just as cake properties are physically realized by their ingredients and interactions, understanding the brain is incredibly useful. But if we want to know, for instance, how to influence minds to achieve particular behaviors, it would be a mistake to look for explanations solely at the level of the brain. These reflections won't be news to many philosophers, but they're worth repeating. Rejecting the mind in an effort to achieve scientific legitimacy, a trend we have seen both in behaviorism and some popular manifestations of neuroscience, is unnecessary and unresponsive to the aims of scientific psychology. Understanding the mind isn't the same as understanding the brain. Fortunately, though, we can achieve such understanding without abandoning scientific rigor. Or, to adopt another baking analogy, we can have our cake and eat it, too.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
Mind versus Matter. Frank Wilczek, Hermann Feschbach Professor of Physics, MIT, co-recipient, 2004 Nobel Prize in Physics, author, The Lightness of Being. The distinction between mind and matter is embedded in everyday language and thinking, and even more deeply in philosophy and theology. The great philosopher-theologian George Berkeley, who famously grounded matter in the mind of God, summed it up in a witticism. What is mind? No matter. What is matter? Never mind. Science has long found it useful to accept this duality as a methodology, if not as a doctrine. In modern physics, matter obeys its own mathematical laws, independent of what anyone, even or maybe especially God, thinks. But the distinction is doomed, and its passing will change our view of everything. Everything, that is, which is mind-matter. Already the walls of separation are crumbling. Three developments have irreversibly undermined them. One, we've learned what matter is, and our new matter, informed over the course of the 20th century by the revelations of relativity, quantum mechanics, and transformational symmetry, is far stranger and richer in potential than anything our ancestors could have dreamed of. It can dance in intricate dynamic patterns. It can exploit environmental resources to self-organize and export entropy. Two, we've learned, theoretically through Turing's vision and practically through the rise of ubiquitous computing, that many accomplishments once viewed as prerogatives of mind, from playing chess to planning itineraries to suggesting friends and sharing interests, are things that machines, whose design hides no secrets, by pure computation can do quite well. Three, we've learned a lot about how the human mind works, as a special capacity of matter. We now know that many aspects of perception begin as specific molecular events. Great challenges remain to bring understanding of memory, emotion, and ultimately creative thought to the same level, but there's every reason to think they too will come into focus. At least, no showstoppers have yet appeared. The eternal, ever-vague problems of free will and consciousness will be retired, with due respect, when mechanistic understanding of how human minds actually work brings in more powerful, less nebulous concepts, as has already happened for computation. More interesting is the question of consequences. Here's a relevant thought experiment. Imagine an artificial intelligence with human-like insight contemplating her own blueprint. What would she make of it? I think it's overwhelmingly likely that among her first thoughts would be how to begin making improvements. This processor could be faster, that memory more capacious, and above all, the reward system more rewarding. Our heroine would surely be inspired, as I am, by William Blake's prophecy. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. In bad science fiction, androids are sometimes horrified to learn they're mere machines. Following the instruction of the Delphic Oracle to know thyself, we find ourselves making a similar discovery. The wise and mature reaction to the realization that mind and matter are mind-matter is to take joy in what a wonderful thing mind-matter can be and is. Intelligence as Property. Alexander Wissner Gross, scientist, inventor, entrepreneur, Institute Fellow, Institute for Applied Computational Science, Harvard University. Since long before Erwin Schrödinger's seminal 1944 work, What is Life?, physicists have aspired to rigorously define the characteristics that distinguish some matter as living and other matter as not. However, the analogous task of identifying the universally distinguishing physical properties of intelligence has remained largely underappreciated. Based on recent discoveries, I have come to suspect that the reason for this lack of progress in physically defining intelligence is due to the scientific concept of intelligence as a static property rather than a dynamical process, a concept ready for retirement. In particular, recent results have shown that a rudimentary physical process called causal entropic forcing can replicate model versions of signature cognitive adaptive behaviors seen previously only in humans and certain non-human animal intelligence tests. These findings suggest that a variety of key characteristics associated with human intelligence, including upright walking, tool use, and social cooperation, should instead be viewed as side effects of a deeper dynamical process that attempts to maximize future freedom of action. This freedom-maximizing process can be said to meaningfully exist only over an extended time period, and therefore is not a static property. It's time we retired studying intelligence as a property. The Grand Analogy. David Gelernter, computer scientist, Yale University, chief scientist, Mirror Worlds Technologies, author, America Light: How Imperial Academia Dismantled Our Culture and Ushered in the Obamacrats. Today, computationalists and cognitive scientists, those researchers who see digital computing as a model for human thought and the mind, are nearly unanimous in believing the grand analogy and teaching it to their students. And whether you accept it or not, the analogy is a milestone of modern intellectual history. It partly explains why a solid majority of contemporary computationalists and cognitive scientists believe that eventually you'll be able to give your laptop a real, not simulated, mind by downloading and executing the right software app. Whereupon, if you tell the machine, "Imagine a rose," it will conjure one up in its mind just as you do. Tell it to recall an embarrassing moment, and it will recall something and feel embarrassed, just as you might. In this view, embarrassed computers are just around the corner. But no such software will ever exist. And the analogy is false, and has slowed our progress in grasping the actual phenomenology of mind. We've barely begun to understand the mind from inside. But what's wrong with this suggestive, provocative analogy? My first reason is old. The other three are new. 1. The software computer system relates to the world in a fundamentally different way from the mind-brain system. Software moves easily among digital computers, but each human mind is, so far, wedded permanently to one brain. The relationship between software and the world at large is arbitrary, determined by the programmer. The relationship between mind and world is an expression of personality and human nature, and no one can arrange it. There are computers without software, but no brains without minds. Software is transparent. I can read off the precise state of the entire program at any time. Minds are opaque. There's no way I can know what you're thinking unless you tell me. Computers can be erased. Minds cannot. Computers can be made to operate precisely as we choose. Minds cannot. And so on. Everywhere we look, we see fundamental differences. 2. The grand analogy presupposes that minds are machines, or virtual machines. But a mind has two equally important functions, doing and being. A machine is only for doing. We build machines to act for us. Minds are different. Yours might be wholly quiet, doing, computing, nothing. Yet you might be feeling miserable or exalted, or you might merely be conscious. Emotions, in particular, aren't actions. They're ways to be. And emotions, states of being, play an important part in the mind's cognitive work. They allow you, for instance, to feel your way to a cognitive goal. He walked to the window to recollect himself and feel how he ought to behave. Jane Austen, Persuasion. Thoughts contain information, but feelings, mild wistfulness, say, on a warm summer morning, contain none. Wistfulness is merely a way to be. Until we understand how to make digital computers feel or experience phenomenal consciousness, we have no business talking up a supposed analogy between mind-brain and software-computer. Those who note that computers that can feel are incredible are sometimes told, "You assert that many billions of tiny, meaningless computer instructions, each unable to feel, could never create a system that feels. Yet neurons are also tiny, meaningless, and feel nothing. But 100 billion of those yields a brain that does feel, which is irrelevant. 100 billion neurons yield a brain that supports a mind, but 100 billion sand grains or used tires yields nothing. You need billions of the right article arranged in the right way to get feeling. 3. The process of growing up is innate to the idea of human being. Social interactions and body structure change over time, and the two sets of changes are intimately connected. A toddler who can walk is treated differently from an infant who can't. No robot could acquire a human-like mind unless it could grow and change physically, interacting with society as it did. But even if we focus on static, snapshot minds, a human mind requires a human body. Bodily sensations create mind states that cause physical changes that create further mind changes. A feedback loop. You're embarrassed, you blush. Feeling yourself blush, your embarrassment increases. Your blush deepens. We don't think with our brains only. We think with our brains and bodies together. We might build simulated bodies out of software, but simulated bodies can't interact in human ways with human beings, and we must interact with other people to become thinking persons. 4. Software is inherently recursive. Recursive structure is innate to the idea of software. The mind is not and cannot be recursive. A recursive structure incorporates smaller versions of itself, an electronic circuit made of smaller circuits, an algebraic expression built of smaller expressions. Software is a digital computer realized by another digital computer. You can find plenty of definitions of digital computer. Realized by means made real or embodied by. The software you build is capable of exactly the same computations as the hardware on which it executes. Hardware is a digital computer realized by electronics or some equivalent medium. Suppose you design a digital computer. You embody it using electronics. So you've got an ordinary computer with no software. Now you design another digital computer, an operating system like Unix. Unix has a distinctive interface and, ultimately, the exact same computing power as the machine it runs on. You run your new computer, Unix, on your hardware computer. Now you build a word processor, yet another dressed-up digital computer, to run on Unix, and so on ad infinitum. The same structure, a digital computer, keeps recurring. Software is inherently recursive. The mind is not and cannot be. You cannot run another mind on yours, and a third mind on that, and a fourth atop the third. Much has been gained by mind science's obsession with computing. Computation has been a useful lens to focus scientific and philosophical thinking on the essence of mind. The last generation has seen, for example, a much clearer view of the nature of consciousness. But we've always known ourselves poorly. We still do. Your mind is a room with a view, and we still know the view, objective reality, a lot better than the room, subjective reality. Today, subjectivism is reemerging among those who see through the grand analogy. Computers are fine, but it's time to return to the mind itself and stop pretending we have computers for brains. We'd be unfeeling, unconscious zombies if we did. Grandmother Cells. Terence J. Sinofsky, Computational Neuroscientist, Francis Crick Professor, Salk Institute for Biological Studies, co-author, with Patricia S. Churchland, The Computational Brain. In 2004, an epilepsy patient at UCLA Medical Center, whose brain was being monitored to detect the origin of the seizures, was shown a series of pictures of celebrities. Electrodes implanted in the memory centers of the patient's brain reported spikes in response to the photos. One of the neurons responded vigorously to several pictures of Jennifer Aniston, but not to other famous people. A neuron in another patient would respond only to pictures of Halle Berry, and even to her name, but not to pictures of Bill Clinton or Julia Roberts or the names of other famous people. Such cells had been predicted 50 years ago, when it first became possible to record from single neurons in the brains of cats and monkeys. It was thought that in the hierarchy of visual areas of the cerebral cortex, the response properties of the neurons became more and more specific the higher the neuron was in the hierarchy, perhaps so specific that a single neuron would respond only to pictures of a single person. This became known as the grandmother cell hypothesis, after the putative neuron in your brain that recognizes your grandmother. The team at UCLA seemed to have found such cells. Single neurons were also found that recognized specific objects and buildings, like the Sydney Opera House. Despite this striking evidence, the grandmother cell hypothesis is unlikely to be correct, or even a good explanation for these recordings. We're beginning to collect recordings from hundreds of cells simultaneously in mice, monkeys, and humans, and these are leading to a different theory for how the cortex perceives and decides. Nonetheless, the grandmother cell hypothesis continues to have adherents, and the thinking that derives from focusing on single neurons still permeates the field of cortical electrophysiology. We'd make progress more quickly if we could retire the proverbial grandmother cell. According to the grandmother cell hypothesis, you perceive your grandmother when the cell is active, so it shouldn't fire to any other stimulus. Only a few hundred pictures were tested, and many more pictures were not tested, so we really don't know how selective the Jennifer Aniston cell was. Second, the likelihood that the electrode by chance happened to record from the only Jennifer Aniston neuron in the brain is low. It's more likely that there are many thousands. The same for the Halle Berry neuron, for everyone you know and every object you can recognize. There are many neurons in the brain, but not enough for each object and name that you know. An even deeper reason to be skeptical of the grandmother cell hypothesis is that the function of a sensory neuron is only partially determined by its response to sensory inputs. Equally important is the output of the neuron and its effects downstream on behavior. In monkeys, where it has been possible to record from many neurons simultaneously, stimuli and task-dependent signals are broadly distributed over large populations of neurons, each tuned to a different combination of features of the stimuli and task detail. The properties of such distributed representations were first studied in artificial neural networks in the 1980s. Populations of simple model neurons called hidden units were trained to perform a mapping between a set of input units and a set of output units. These hidden units developed patterns of activity for each input that was highly distributed, like what has been observed in populations of cortical neurons. For example, the input units could represent faces from many different angles, and the output units could represent the names of the people. After being trained on many examples, each of the hidden units coded different combinations of features of the input units, such as fragments of eyes, noses, or head shapes. A distributed representation can be used to recognize many versions of the same object, and the same set of neurons can recognize many different objects by differently weighting their outputs. Moreover, the network can generalize by correctly classifying new inputs from outside the training set. Much more powerful versions of these early neural network models, with more than 12 layers of hidden units in a hierarchy like that in our visual cortex, and using deep learning to adjust billions of synaptic weights, are now able to recognize tens of thousands of objects in images. This is a breakthrough in artificial intelligence, because performance continues to improve as the size of the network and the number of training examples increases. Companies worldwide are racing to build special-purpose hardware that would scale up these architectures. There's still a long way to go before the current systems approach the capacity of the human brain, which has a billion synapses in every cubic millimeter of cortex. How many neurons are needed in a population that can discriminate between many similar objects, such as faces? From imaging studies, we know that many areas of the brain respond to faces, some with a high degree of selectivity. We'll need to sample many neurons widely from these areas. The answer to this question may be a surprise, because there are also sound theoretical arguments for minimizing the numbers of neurons in the representation of an object. First, sparse coding would be more energy efficient. Second, learning a new object in the same population of neurons leads to interference with the others being represented in the population. An effective and efficient representation would be sparsely distributed. In 10 years, 1,000 times more neurons will be recorded and manipulated than is now possible, and new techniques are being developed to analyze them, which could lead to a deeper understanding of how activity in populations of neurons gives rise to thoughts, emotions, plans, and decisions. We may soon know the answer to the question of how many neurons represent an object or a concept in our brain. But will this retire the grandmother cell hypothesis?
Brain modules. Patricia S. Churchland, philosopher, neuroscientist, University of California, San Diego. Author, Touching a Nerve. The concept of module in neuroscience, meaning sufficient for a function, given gas in the tank background conditions, invariably causes more confusion than clarity. The problem is that any neuronal business of any significant complexity is underpinned by spatially distributed networks, and not just incidentally, but essentially, and not just cortically, but between cortical and subcortical networks. This is true, for example, of motion perception and pattern recognition, as well as motor control and reinforcement learning, not to mention feelings such as mustering courage to face a threat or deciding to hide instead of run. It's true of self-control and moral judgment. It's likely to be true of conscious experience. The output of a network can vary as the activity of the network's individual neurons vary. What's poorly understood is how nervous systems solve the coordination problem. That is, how does the brain orchestrate the right pattern of neuronal activation across networks to get the job done? This isn't all that's amiss with module. Traditionally, modules are supposed to be encapsulated, aka insulated. But even the degree to which an early sensory area, such as primary visual cortex, V1, is encapsulated, has been challenged. Visual neurons in V1 double their firing rate if the animal is running, no matter the identity of the visual input across conditions, to take but one example. To add to the module mess, it turns out that specialization in an area such as the V1 appears to depend to some non-trivial degree on the statistics of the input. Visual cortex is visual largely because it's connected to the retina and not the cochlea, for example. Notice that in blind subjects, the visual cortex is recruited in reading Braille, a high-resolution spatial and somatosensory task. As would be expected if specialization depends on the statistics of the network's input, infant brains have much more plasticity in regional specialization than do mature brains. Doris Trauner and Elizabeth Bates discovered that human infants with a left hemispherectomy can learn language quite normally, whereas an adult who undergoes the same surgery will have severe language deficits. I think of module in the way I think of nervous breakdown. Mildly useful in the old days when we had no clue about what was going on under the skull, but of doubtful explanatory significance these days.
Bias is always bad. Tom Griffiths, Associate Professor of Psychology, Director, Computational Cognitive Science Laboratory and the Institute of Cognitive and Brain Sciences, University of California, Berkeley. Being biased seems like a bad thing. Intuitively, we equate rationality and objectivity. When faced with a difficult question, a rational agent, it seems, shouldn't have a predisposition for one answer over another. If a new algorithm designed to find objects in images or interpret natural language is described as biased, it sounds like a poor algorithm. And when psychology experiments show that people are systematically biased in the judgments they form and the decisions they make, we begin to question human rationality. But bias isn't always bad. In fact, for certain kinds of questions, the only way to produce better answers is to be biased. Many of the most challenging problems humans solve are known as inductive problems, problems where the right answer cannot be definitively identified based on the available evidence. Finding objects in images and interpreting natural language are two classic examples. An image is just a two-dimensional array of pixels, a set of numbers indicating whether locations are light or dark, green or blue. An object is a three-dimensional form, and many different combinations of three-dimensional forms can result in the same pattern of numbers in a set of pixels. Seeing a particular pattern of numbers doesn't tell us which of these possible three-dimensional forms is present. We have to weigh the available evidence and make a guess. Likewise, extracting the words from the raw sound pattern of human speech requires making an informed guess about the particular sentence a person might have uttered. The only way to solve inductive problems well is to be biased. Because the available evidence isn't enough to determine the right answer, you need to have predispositions independent of that evidence. And how well you solve the problem, how often your guesses are correct, depends on having biases that reflect how likely different answers are. Human beings are very good at solving inductive problems. Finding objects in images and interpreting natural language are two problems that people still solve better than computers. And the reason is that human minds have biases finely tuned for solving these problems. The biases of the human visual system are apparent in many visual illusions, images that result in a surprising discrepancy between our biased guesses and what's actually in the world. The rarity of visual illusions in real life is testimony to the utility of those biases. By studying the kinds of illusions the human visual system is susceptible to, we can identify the biases that guide perception and instantiate those biases in algorithms used by computers. Human biases in interpreting language are demonstrated in the game of telephone, or when we misinterpret the lyrics of a song. It's also easy to discover the biases built into speech recognition software. I once left my office for a meeting, locking the door behind me, and came back to find that a stranger had broken in and typed a series of poetic sentences into my computer. Who was this person, and what did the message mean? After a few spooky, puzzling minutes, I realized that I'd left my speech recognition software running, and the sentences were the guesses it had produced about what the rustling of the trees outside my window meant. But the fact that they were fairly intelligible English sentences reflected the biases of the software, which didn't even consider the possibility that it was listening to the wind rather than a person. Things that people do well, vision and language, depend heavily on our being biased toward particular answers. Algorithms that solve those problems well have similar biases. So we shouldn't be surprised to discover that people are systematically biased in other domains. These biases don't necessarily reflect a deviation from rationality. They reflect the difficulty of the problems that humans need to solve. And one way to make computers better at solving these problems is understanding exactly what human biases are like for different problems. In arguing that bias isn't always bad, I'm not claiming that it's always good. Objectivity can be an ideal we strive for on moral grounds, say when assessing other people. The more information and time we have available, the closer we can get to this ideal. But this kind of objectivity is a luxury, at odds with reaching the right answers in limited time from small amounts of evidence. When solving inductive problems, it can be rational to be biased. Cartesian Hydrolysism. Robert Kurzban, Professor of Psychology, University of Pennsylvania, Director, Penn Laboratory for Experimental Evolutionary Psychology, PLEEP, Author, Why Everyone Else is a Hypocrite. In the 17th century, René Descartes proposed that the nervous system worked a bit like the nifty statues in the Royal Gardens of Saint-Germain, whose moving parts were animated by water running through pipes inside them. Descartes' idea is illustrated in the well-known line drawing in many introductory psychology textbooks, showing a person sticking his foot in a fire, presumably to illustrate Descartes' idea about hydraulic reflexes. 3 centuries on, in the mid-1900s, the detritus of the hydraulic conception of behavior, now known to be luminously wrong, was strewn about here and there. In the scholarly literature, for instance, there were traces in Freud's corpus. Catharsis will relieve all that pressure. Among the folk, hydraulic metaphors were, and still are, used to express mental states. I'm going to blow my top. Having written an essay for Edge today, I feel drained. There is, to be sure, still plenty of debate about how the mind works. No doubt, even in the answers to this year's Edge question, there will be spirited discussion about how well the brain as device that computes notion is doing in attempts to advance psychology. Still, while the computational theory of mind may not have won over everyone, the hydraulic model that Descartes proposed is dead and buried. Well, dead anyway. Buried, maybe not. And to be sure, hydraulics is, as it turned out, the right explanation for a pretty important male biological function, just not the one Descartes had in mind. The metaphor is recruiting the intuition that the mind is built of fluid-filled pipes along with junctions, valves, and reservoirs, point to the possibility that Descartes was drawn to the notion of a hydraulic mind not only because of the technology of the day, but also because there's something intuitively compelling about the idea. And indeed, Cartesian hydraulics has been revived in at least one incarnation in the scholarly literature, though I doubt it's the only one. For the last decade or so, some researchers have been advancing the notion that there is a reservoir of willpower. You can't have an empty reservoir, the theory goes, in order to exert self-control, resisting eating marshmallows, avoiding distractions, etc. And as the reservoir gets drained, it becomes harder and harder to exert self-control. Given how wrong Descartes was about how the mind works, it's pretty clear that this sort of idea just can't be right. There have recently been a number of experimental results that disconfirm predictions made by the model, but that's not why the idea should be abandoned. Or, at least, the data aren't the best reason the idea should be abandoned. The reason the idea should be left to die is the same reason that Descartes' idea should be. Although the mind might not work just like a digital computer, no doubt the mind is different from your basic PC in any number of important ways, we do know that computation of some sort is much, much more likely to be a good explanation for human behavior than hydraulics is. People will disagree about whether Max Planck was right about the speed of scientific change. Psychology, I would argue, has a couple of handicaps that might make the discipline more susceptible to Planck's worries than some other disciplines. First, theories in psychology are often driven by, indeed held captive by, our intuitions. I'm fond of the way Daniel Dennett put it in Consciousness Explained, 1991, when he was talking about the, also luminously wrong, idea of the Cartesian theater, the dualist idea that there's a special center in the brain, the epicenter of identity, the one and true me, the wizard behind the curtain. He thought this notion was the most tenacious bad idea bedeviling our attempts to think about consciousness. Human intuitions tell us that there's a special me in there somewhere, an intuition that serves to resurrect the idea of a special center over and over again. Second, psychologists are too polite with one another's ideas. Economists, for example, in my experience, don't frequently commit this particular sin. In 2013, a prominent journal in psychology published a paper reporting the results of attempts to replicate a previously published finding. The title of the article was, before the colon, the phenomenon in question, and then, after the colon, real or elusive phenomenon. The pairing of real versus elusive, as opposed to non-existent, suggests that it's considered rude to label a result as a false positive rather than something that's simply hard to replicate, so rude that people in the field won't even say out loud that the prior work may have pointed to something that isn't really there. Of course, intuitions interfere with theoretical innovation in other disciplines. No doubt the obviousness of the sun going around the earth, bending across the sky each day, delayed acceptance of the heliocentric model. Everyone knows the mind isn't a hydraulic shovel, but it does feel as though some sort of reservoir of stuff gets used up, just as it does feel like the sun is moving and we're not. Still, it's time that Cartesian hydraulicism be put to rest in the same way Cartesian dualism was.